up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell. The cook in the lunchroom ready to sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat.
Hello, everyone. My name is Leonie Hameson. Welcome to our show, Talk Out of Schools, on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM, where we focus on issues affecting public schools here in New York City, at the state level, and nationally. Our show is also available for download as a podcast. During the next hour, we'll be talking with three New York City teachers about the challenges they face with remote online instruction and how they think schools should be restructured next year. But first, I'd like to update you on the latest education news. The New York City Panel for Educational Policy, which is our appointed school board, was voting today on many contracts, many of them extensions of existing contracts. Among them was over $200 million for busing for the month of March, with another $200 million for April, suggesting that the DOE intended to extend these contracts to the end of the year at a total cost of about $700 million. Meanwhile, our schools are closed and they aren't using any busing. When I read that proposal, the top of my head blew off. $700 million for busing that we aren't using, while the mayor's planning on cutting $800 million from education next year. There's a bunch of other proposed contracts for millions to be spent this school year on additional nurses, professional development, custodial supplies, and consultants, all without sufficient justification in the memo to the PEP. When I read the memo last week, I immediately forwarded it to the New York City Comptroller to seek his views. A few days later, he wrote an excellent letter to the Chancellor asking a bunch of important questions about why the spending on busing is needed, especially as there's something in these contracts called force majeure that allows either party to cancel them if there's an unexpected emergency like an epidemic. Sue Edelman of the New York Post also wrote a great bunch of stories about this, and now the DOE has delayed the vote to next Wednesday and is apparently engaging in further discussions with City Hall and the Office of Management and Budget. So keep your fingers crossed. Hopefully the DOE will withdraw these proposals, save more than $700 million, which would theoretically allow them to restore most of the budget cuts to schools planned for next year. You can check out my blog, New York City Public School Parents, for links to the New York Post articles, the controller's letter, and more information about unnecessary proposed spending by DOE for this school year. Now I'd like to bring in three New York City teachers, Liat Olenek, Bobson Wong, and Katie Blapham. Are you there, guys?
Yes.
Hello? Hello? Are you all three of you there? Hi, great. Thank you so much for joining us and taking the time. I've never had three guests on at once, and I'm sort of new at this game, so I'm hoping it works out. If any of you fall off the line, please wait, and the engineer will call you back. I have a lot of issues that I want to cover today. First of all, briefly, can you tell us what you teach and what a typical day of remote teaching is like for you? Liat, do you want to start?
Sure, yes. Hi, everybody. My name's Liat. I teach in an elementary school in Brooklyn, and I am a cluster teacher. I teach science, so that means I don't have my own classroom, and I see multiple classes. So it definitely looks different for me in remote learning than for classroom teachers. But basically, I join morning meetings with kids every day to have face-to-face connections with them. And then I create resources and lessons and activities for science for all students in the school to do at least one science activity every week.
And you talk to your kids
and look at their work and so on.
And how do you communicate with your students?
So at my school, we are using Google Classroom. So we use Google Meet for live sessions and meetings where we can talk with students face-to-face. We're also reaching out to to do one-on-ones with students and their families throughout the day and throughout the week. And then we use the Google Classroom site to comment on student work, post assignments, give resources, suggestions, things like that.
Okay, and so how about you, Bobson? How are you doing this?
Okay, so I'm Bobson Wong. I teach at a large public high school in Queens, and I teach, since I teach high school, I teach specific courses. In my case, it's Algebra 1, Geometry, and AP Stats. So for me, online learning is a combination of Google Meet online meetings and posting assignments on Google Classroom, which means I try to stay in touch with students through regular online meetings and reading through their assignments online. So I may be in touch with them by email, or I'm also in touch with parents through text messaging. And so it's a lot of stuff on Google Classroom and a lot of Google's G Suite tools.
And how about you, Katie?
Hi, I'm Katie, and I am an elementary school teacher in Brooklyn. I'm the, I'm the ESL teacher at my school. It's now called English as a New Language, but most people know it as English as a Second Language. So I'm a service provider, which is a little different. I don't have my own classroom. Before this happened, before remote learning happened, I pushed into classrooms to support my students with their classwork. So I, like Liat was saying, I also attend meetings, classroom meetings. I'll go into their classroom page and go on their meetings and see them face-to-face, see them live. I'll comment on their work, offer them feedback on Google Classroom, mostly with regards to, like, their writing assignments and, like, reading responses. I can write some feedback there. But I also, my teaching has shifted as a result of online learning. I am now meeting with small groups and newcomer English language learners who need, like, a lot of support with the language, a lot of, you know, beginning ESL work. So I do have live meetings with students every day. I have a book club. I have, actually now I have this week, beginning this week, I have two book clubs. And then I meet with, like I said, the newcomer L's. So, and then I do some, like, check-ins with some of my advanced English language learners where, you know, we just talk about, like, what they're doing in class. I know what they're working on because I've been able to, like, go into their classrooms and know what's going on. So I can ask them questions about the books that they're reading with their teachers and things like that. But it's more of, like, a check-in, just, like, sort of social, emotional. We do, like, fun activities. So I do a range of things with my kids.
When I was talking to you earlier, you really have kids from all over the world. How many different languages do the kids that you teach speak at home?
Oh, I don't know. French, Hebrew, Spanish, Georgian, 4 or 5 different languages. Japanese, Polish. Oh yeah. So, it is mixed. And my kids are grouped not by what their home language is, because I have, like, just one Polish. I have one Japanese. So, it's definitely a mix.
It's really like a UN that you manage all these kids. It's fantastic. So I think that two of you, Bobson and Katie, you both have young kids. And what I've heard from a lot of teachers is that the demands of teaching while trying to manage their kids at home is sometimes overwhelming. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Bobson, and how you're managing to do that?
Well, it is a real challenge. I have two kids who are in elementary school, and so trying to stay on top of what they're doing while trying to stay on top of what my own students are doing is very tricky. I spend a lot of time in the morning trying to get them started, laying out their assignments for them. I print out as many things as I can because I'm fortunate enough to have a printer at home. And the reason why I do that is to cut down on the amount of screen time that my own children are doing, because I don't want them sitting in front of a computer screen all day. But it's tricky for younger children because they're not able to work completely independently for the whole day. So they'll be constantly asking me questions or asking for clarifications, or then there may be an online meeting that one of them may want to attend. And then meanwhile, I'm trying to do my own stuff for my own classes. So at some point, some things just have to give. So not all the, my kids don't attend, my own children don't attend all the online meetings that their classes have, because I just don't have the capacity to manage that. It's tricky.
Katie, yeah, it sounds overwhelming to me. Katie, how are you managing with that?
I have good days and bad days. Monday was a really hard day as a parent. I have a fifth grader, so I have just one child in elementary school, and she's really struggling with remote learning. She finds it overwhelming. She finds the whole group, the whole class Zoom meet or Google Meet meetings to be just too much for her. So she sometimes shuts down and doesn't want to do the work. So for me, it's like I feel like I'm having to be like her therapist. I have to really like take time out of my day to sit with her to address her social emotional needs. And she can pretty much do the work independently, but for math, she won't do the math unless I'm sitting next to her. Even though she can do the math, she wants me to be like sitting right next to her. So I have to carve out time during the school day to sit with her. So it's a lot. I feel like I'm all over the place. But I have to say, she's been super helpful with my lessons. She really likes to be part of my live lessons and to help me out. And so my students have gotten to know her better. So sometimes
she'll
join me. And she's sort of motivated by that. So even though that's not really doing what her teacher has assigned, it is still, like, meaningful work. So I try and, incorporate her into my teaching as much as possible.
So what are some of the innovations that you guys have made teaching remotely that have been more successful in keeping your students engaged? Leah, do you want to start?
Sure. And this isn't something that I alone have done, but a practice at my school in general. One thing we've found is doing clubs that are like live, smaller group meetings that are for fun, like a movie club or a collage club, or I'm doing a climate activism club or a comic book club, where kids can kind of just connect with each other and talk about a shared interest with teacher support, has been really successful at just keeping kids plugged in and engaged and breaking up the day at home and making sure that they're still connecting with their peers and building friendships and having their social emotional needs met.
So these clubs meet like once a week or twice a week? How often?
It varies. The one I'm doing is once a week. Some of them are twice a week. Kind of depends on the teacher and the student's age. Like Bobson said, the younger kids, it is much harder because they can't really interact with Google Classroom independently. So you need parent support and parent buy-in to be able to participate, especially in live sessions. So it varies by age.
Bobson, do you have some innovations that you've made along the way? I know it's only been a few weeks, but what's working
right
for you?
One thing that I've been, two things that I've been doing that are relatively new for me are, I've always been posting my homework online, but posting them as Google Docs allows students to write directly in the documents and upload their work to the computer without having to print things out. So it's been interesting to see students show their work, show mathematical work on a computer because they're not used to that. So I have students who are writing directly into the files because they have a touch screen and they have a stylus. I have students who are actually typing, learning how to type mathematical symbols, which is, it's not so much an innovation for me as it is an innovation for them because they're not used to it. And then this whole idea of the online meetings is new for me and my students. And so working out the dynamics of what is appropriate online instruction and what will work and what won't work, that's also been kind of interesting for me.
Sounds very challenging. I mean, I can't imagine doing mathematical formulas and calculations and all that on a computer, but I suppose, you know, that's the wave of the future in some way. Katie, what I know you told me something really cool that you did with your kids, a scavenger hunt. Do you want to talk about that?
So I've been doing a lot of online remote learning has provided me with more freedom to teach and to kind of like customize educational experiences for my individual students that I wasn't really able to do back when school was in session, especially now I would be giving like the 9th class exam, so I wouldn't even be pushing in. I would not even be working with kids right now. But so I've been doing scavenger hunts. So this week, since today is Earth Day, we did like a plastic scavenger hunt. And I was having kids find examples of things containing plastic that they use that they find in their bathroom, in their kitchen, in their bedroom. And then so they get up and they go and find these things and bring them back to the computer, and I do the same. Like, I mean, I'm working. You can see my kitchen in the background. So I basically, like, they can see me, like, going into the refrigerator, taking out plastic things, and then I show them, like, plastic containers or whatever. And then they show me their plastic items, and then this gives them an opportunity to, like, talk about what they find and, there's room for critical thinking, too. Like, do you think this item could exist without plastic? Like, what other materials could we use for this item? It depends on their English proficiency level. But that's been fun because it's like show and tell, and kids love show and tell. And I do this with, like, adjectives, like find something soft, find something shiny. So that's just been, like, just really, like, trying to make it fun and engaging and meaningful. One of my students is really interested in dogs. So we're doing like an independent dog study. So I'm finding in my apartment, luckily since I have a child, I have a bunch of picture books. So I'm reading with this student picture books about dogs and incorporating, they're doing, looking out the window and observing dogs they see in their neighborhood and writing about it, drawing pictures about it. So it's very much like related to like what's going on in their daily lives. And I'm able to do more of that now than I ever was able to at school because we were basically having to follow scripted curriculum and you know, prepare them for state tests.
So that sounds like a lot of fun, actually. What are some of the ongoing challenges or frustrations that you guys haven't yet solved with remote learning? Bobson, you want to go first?
Sure. One big challenge that I've been having is keeping students engaged and engaging students. It's very hard to know what students are thinking. If all they're doing is submitting an assignment online. And even if I have an online meeting, first of all, not all students are able to attend because They may not have internet access at that time. They may have to be taken care of relatives or other family members, or they may be, just be tired. So, in a classroom, I'm able to look at a student and judge based on the student's body language, on what the student is looking at, what the student is doing, what the student is thinking. I mean, that's what teachers do. I mean, I can read what they're thinking and how, and I can adjust my instruction appropriately. When we switch to online learning, I've lost most of that capability. So I don't know if in an online meeting whether they're really paying attention to me or whether they're just texting their friends. And I can't make them turn on their video because they may not want to show what their home is like. They it will increase the bandwidth. It will boot me out of my own meeting sometimes. One of the biggest challenges for me has been adjusting my instruction so that I know how they're doing. And it's very difficult to do that because not everyone is even submitting stuff. And even when they're submitting stuff, I don't know who's, did they do it? Did they struggle with it? Did they just get help? Did they use some app to help them? I don't know. It's very difficult to gauge instruction. And so assessment is kind of the other component of that that's tricky, because if I don't really know what they're thinking, how do I realistically judge what they've learned? And that's a big unanswered question for a lot of people.
How many people actually check into your class? Like what percent on a daily basis?
So it started out at around 1/3, and I've actually been able to increase that to maybe about a half to 60%, depending on the class. At first I said that these meetings were optional, and now that we're in this for the long haul, I've started gradually sending the message that these are not, they're not quite optional, but they're not quite mandatory. So what I've been saying is you should be attending these online meetings at least twice a week, because I think that's a reasonable compromise between mandating showing up at a certain time and just not showing up at all. But I also said that, if you have an issue, then talk to me. Let me know. I mean, what I really want to convey, the message that I really want to convey is I need to hear from you. I can't just see you submit something and then that's it, because I need to know what you're thinking. So I think that message of building on the relationships that I've established with students and saying, I mean, come on, let's be reasonable here. If you're struggling, I need to know. If you're having a problem, let me know, because I'm here to help you. I'm not here to just to judge you. It's a difficult message to convey at a time like this.
When we had a conversation about a week ago, you said that there were some students who you hadn't heard from at all, and you were suspecting that they may have left the country. Is that still true?
Well, I don't know about leaving the country. I do know that they've left. I have heard about students who left the area. I know about some students who went out of state because their families took them out of state. I know a lot of students who have left the city, and they're now out on the island or upstate or something. And some students I literally haven't heard from at all. And I've tried reaching out to I've spoken to their guidance counselors and other school personnel, and we've all tried to reach them. And some of them we've been able to reach, some of them we haven't. It's frustrating and it's scary, because some of these are students that were doing very well earlier in the year. And we really don't know what's happened to them. Some of the stories that I've heard about what some of the students have gone through, about the loss of family members, has been just heartbreaking. And so we have to take that into account when we think about all the things that we're trying to do here.
Right. Do you have a sense that all your kids have devices and internet access or not?
I think most of them do. As far as I can tell, and I think my school has been pretty good at trying to contact every student, and from what I've heard, a lot of other schools have been doing a phenomenal job of just trying to reach out to students, because it's a monumental task, and it's extremely difficult to try and do that.
Liat, what are some of the challenges that you're facing, and have you been able to keep your students engaged over time?
Yeah, I think I agree with Bobson. It's sometimes it feels like you're putting out these things into a void, and you don't really have a sense of who's really engaging with them and how and what it means to the kids, unless, you know, they provide really specific evidence, like a video or something like that, showing them doing whatever it is. For me, I think the biggest challenge is definitely just the range of home experiences that my students have. I teach in a really diverse school, and we have students who are homeless and students who are in their second homes in the Hamptons. So it's a real range. And obviously, the students whose parents still have resources and jobs and who have quiet spaces at home to work are much more able to participate in remote learning than students who may be living with many family members in a small space, or maybe living in a shelter, or even maybe responsible for caring for younger siblings, or just don't have parents who are able to help them navigate remote learning. So a lot of our effort and a lot of the teachers at my school's effort have been reaching out to those families who don't have as many resources to try and engage them and see what they need. But, you know, at a certain point, there's just a lack of equity, and it's a big obstacle in terms of having everybody engaged and everybody participating.
Do you have a sense whether most or all of your students have devices at this point and access to the internet or not?
I believe, yes, most of them do. I think, but there's also variety within that. So, for example, in live meetings, some students may be accessing from a parent's phone without reliable internet, and some students may be accessing from their own laptop or, you know, even a laptop they got from school. And that's a different experience that allows them to engage in a different way. And if they're only able to use that device for a part of the day or have internet for part of a day, that could affect their ability to participate as well. But what my school, we actually distributed our school devices as soon as it was announced that schools were closed, so we didn't wait for the DOE to provide devices to our families that needed them. So I think in that way, we made sure that at least almost all of our students do have at least one device at home.
And were those mostly laptops?
Mostly iPads.
Mostly iPads. Katie, what about you? What are some of the ongoing challenges that you haven't yet solved, either in terms of engaging kids or making sure that they have the proper ability to be engaged at this point?
Yeah, I think all of our students have been accounted for. That's not to say that every student is participating all the time, no. But we distributed that first week when we found out that schools were closing. We were able to get laptops into the hands of families. They got the laptop, so I think pretty much everyone. I can't say for sure 100% has some kind of device and internet access. For me, I've always been face-to-face, hands-on kind of teacher. Even when I push into the classrooms, fourth and fifth graders are writing they're doing their writing on Chromebooks. I even that was a struggle for me to conference with them on their writing that's online. I find it so much it's much easier to conference with them on writing when I'm sitting next to them. And when they've written it out by hand on paper, that's always been my struggle. When I go in and the kids are writing on Chromebooks, I'm like, oh God, I'm not good at I'm getting better and I'm having to because of remote learning, offering online payback, but it's not comfortable for me. So that's been like a personal struggle for me, is not being able to sit next to them, because my work is very like one individualized and one on one, and I can't sit next to them and help them in that way.
It's frustrating.
It is really frustrating. And the community, the teachers are doing such a great job of like building community, maintaining community. And I'm trying that too, but you know, that's been hard. The students who, haven't been attending the live meetings, like how hard do I push them? Just trying to navigate that, you know, reaching out to the parents, talking to the parents about getting their kids to attend the meetings, and you know, how far do I go? You know, trying to figure that out. So I know that my own child struggles. Like, she really does not like the online the live meetings, and so I kind of like have that perspective. So
It's hard to know how hard to push at this point when kids have different reactions to remote learning and are facing hugely different circumstances at home. At the beginning of the show, I briefly talked about some of the mayor's proposed budget cuts for next year and for this year, actually. But I'm wondering whether you guys have thought about this. Basically, he's proposing more than $800 million in cuts to education next year, which includes a hiring freeze at all schools and $100 million cut directly in school funding via the Fair Student Funding formula. Liat, I know you've thought a little bit about this. Do you want to begin?
Yeah, definitely. I'm extremely concerned about the cuts, and I also think one, it's important to recognize that part of why these are happening is because Governor Cuomo underfunded public schools in the state budget, which was avoidable and unnecessary. He could have raised revenue by taxing the ultra-rich in New York State to avoid cuts to schools and hospitals, but he did not. But now that we, you know, are in this situation, the mayor, I think, you know, it's almost mind-boggling to cut funding for schools at this moment when our students need more resources than ever. And if we're imagining a scenario in which we do return to school in some form in September, our students are going to be recovering from severe trauma. I mean, we have school communities that are losing staff to coronavirus. We have students who are losing family members. And the idea that we would cut directly funding for school budgets in this moment, I think, is atrocious. And, you know, as a particular example, when school budgets are cut, often the first thing to go is counseling and mental health support and social workers. And, you know, our students are going to need those resources when we return to school, and remotely they need those resources as we navigate this pandemic as it evolves. And then the other piece is that when budgets are cut, class sizes get bigger. And in a moment where it seems like we're going to have to do some form of social distancing for at least a year, if not more, it doesn't seem safe at all to do something that would increase class sizes. So I think, like you mentioned earlier, there are lots of opportunities to make cuts to other contracts that the DOE has rather than making cuts directly to school budgets. And that's what I hope the city will do.
Yeah, I know that California is talking about cutting class sizes in half to social distance properly, and already Denmark and Germany are doing similar things. And I think that those kinds of moves are really, really important to think about for our schools as well next year, both for academic and social emotional reasons, as well as health reasons. Leah, I know you have to go soon, but I wanted to ask you before you leave, about Earth Day. Since today is the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, I know originally there were all sorts of activities that were going to happen outside in connection with this day, and you were not only a science teacher but also a climate activist. What should people be doing today in honor of Earth Day and in order to address the climate crisis?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking that. You know, I think it can seem like, why would we do something for Earth Day right now because of this other crisis that happens? But the reality we're seeing is that these two crises, the climate crisis and coronavirus, are deeply connected, partly in that, the communities that are being hit the hardest by climate change are the same ones that are being hit the hardest by coronavirus. And those communities are our students who are facing the brunt of both of these crises. So for me as an educator, and especially as a science teacher, I feel like part of my job is to fight for climate action while we still have time, because it's my kids' futures. So some things that people can do today, obviously we are not going to take to the streets by the millions because that would not be safe. But we are hoping that millions of people across the country and thousands across New York City will take action from home. So for people in New York City listening, you can go to earthweeknyc.com. It's earthweeknyc.com. And there are resources for taking action from home for today, for tomorrow, and for Friday. And that includes resources for teachers as well, because today is the strike day. We're asking people basically to make a sign, post a picture of themselves with their sign on social media, tagging elected officials that they want to take climate action. And then tomorrow is all about stopping climate finance. So institutions like JP Morgan Chase and BlackRock that are funding climate destruction, so there are actions to target them. And then Friday is a future-looking day, so it includes voter registration, census, outreach, so everyone should fill out their census, and then also climate teach-ins for students. So if you're an educator, if you're a parent, if you're a student, there are resources on that website, earthweeknyc.com, to participate or lead those kinds of teach-ins for Friday.
That's great. I'll put that URL on the WBAI and all the podcast text. I have in front of me a letter that we drafted off a model letter to the head of JP Morgan Chase, where we have our family's personal accounts and I have my business account, urging him to divest from fossil fuels. He's JP Morgan Chase is one of the biggest investors in fossil fuels. And so that move would be really important to get us off that, to start addressing and lowering CO2 emissions. Thank you so much for being here, Liat. I know you have to step off, but I think that Bobson and Katie, you guys can stay. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks again, Liat. Talk to you soon. One of the questions that I think is really important, and we touched on this briefly just a second ago, is what is school going to be like if it reopens in the fall, assuming that school buildings will be open and remote learning will have ended as the primary means of communication and instruction with your students? How would you like to see the schools revamped, if any? Especially given the mayor's statement recently that he wants next year to be the best year ever, both in terms of academics and in terms of social-emotional support, given that we've had so many months where there's, you know, been a loss of learning and so many traumatic experiences even, or difficult experience for your students. If you could design the best school year ever, no holds barred, how would you do it? Bobson, do you want to go first?
Sure. I'd like to see implemented a lot of the things that we got talked about, more support, social and emotional support for students, more counseling, more space for students to just work through their feelings. More support for teachers, not just the support for technology, which of course is going to be a critical part of this, but also just the social and emotional support, I think, has also been missing. And in terms of technology, yeah, we do need to make sure that every student has a device that's working and that teachers have enough training so that we can implement assignments that are reasonable and doable for students at home. And also just kind of a reassessment of what testing is and assessment is like in this kind of environment. I'm not completely opposed to testing. I'm not completely opposed even to standardized testing. But I do think that we should think very carefully about what tests are used for and what assessments are used for. I mean, tests are written to evaluate students' learning. They're not really geared to measure the effectiveness of teachers. And, you know, it's in my ideal world, we would take a harder look at that and look at our priorities and our long-term goals to make sure that we can maximize the learning that our students can do in a very difficult environment.
That's great. Any thoughts about class size? First of all, what are your class sizes? And how many students do you teach?
Well, I teach typically around 30 students per class. And so it would be a lot easier if we could have smaller class sizes, not just for the social distancing, but also just for the management. I mean, I've had classes with as few as 15 to 20, and those classes are amazing compared to a class of 34 because you can spend just so much more time with students. And if you have remote learning, you can actually do that more easily because when you have fewer students, you can build better relationships with them. And I feel like giving teachers the time to build those relationships with students is critical at a time like this because those relationships give the students the motivation to do work, or they give students the motivation not to do work, depending on the kind of relationship that teachers and students have. And in an environment where teachers aren't there to monitor what students are doing all the time, it's critical to build meaningful relationships with students.
Right, right. And there is a lot of research showing that smaller classes not only allow more academic feedback and support to students from teachers, but also engage kids more because they are building that personal relationship and they stay more focused and really want to produce in order to please their teachers. Katie, briefly, do you have any thoughts about what you would like to see next year in terms of how schools would be structured, schools and classrooms, if you had your way?
Yeah, it would look very different from what it is now. Well, what you know, the school year is like now. I totally smaller class sizes, more small group work, project-based learning. I think project-based learning needs to be the focus of instruction next year because that's ongoing. You can really like build off of it. It's meaningful, especially project-based learning that incorporates student interest. And, you know, the test prep, that is just going to, like, demoralize them. I mean, it already does, but they want meaningful work, and we really need to provide that, give them that next year. When the mayor was talking about making it our best year ever, I don't know what he really meant by that, but for me, incorporating student interest, I love Liat's school is doing those clubs via remote learning. I think that's fantastic, and we need to see more of that next year, hopefully if we're back in the school building. offering kids more clubs based on what they're interested in.
There's a professor at Harvard who's written a book about where he went into high schools especially and looked at what was happening in high schools. And he said the best kind of learning was going on in extracurricular activities for the high school students, whether it was acting, music, science clubs, whatever. That was where they were doing their best kind of learning, and that's where they were most engaged as opposed to their actual classroom work. This is Lainey Hameson on WBAI FM 99.5 with Talk Out of School. We've been talking to New York City teachers about the emergency shutdown during the pandemic and the challenges of remote learning. Now we'd like to open up the phone lines. Please call in with your questions or concerns to Bobson Wong and Katie Lapham. The number is 212-209-2877. Again, that's 212-209-2877. There have been a lot of questions to the mayor and chancellor about what the grading and promotion policy should be this year, given the highly unusual circumstances of what's happened, the fact that many students still don't have devices or access to the internet or are suffering real hardships at home, and that the situation has seemed to broaden the inequities that already exist in the system. Other districts around the country are instituting pass-fail. San Francisco is giving all students an A for this year. What do you think the grading and promotion policy should be in New York City? Bobson, you want to start?
Sure. If I had the power, I would love to see for this marking period of this semester something like a pass or incomplete as grades. I think it's extremely difficult in a normal environment to quantify grades. And I think in an environment like this, it's even harder to try and quantify grades when we don't know if students are doing the work themselves. We don't know what kind of environment they're working in. To try and apply that level of precision to quantify is next to impossible and not terribly meaningful. Failing students in this kind of environment, I mean, are they not doing the work because they don't have internet access, because they don't have enough adult supervision at home, because their home is just too noisy, because they're taking care of a younger sibling? I mean, who knows? I think that trying to be compassionate and trying to give kids time and space to do some kind of meaningful work is going to be more important than trying to attach a numerical or even a letter grade to that.
Right.
I mean, how do you measure content? How do you measure content knowledge when they can text their friends or just Google answers? You know, it's hard to imagine.
Mm-hmm. And so for those students that got incomplete, would they have to attend summer school, if in your view, or retake the course? How would that work?
It's a good question. I mean, perhaps give them more time to work over the summer. I'm not sure what summer school would look like, because I don't even know if we'd be able to hold a physical summer school. It might be a matter of just giving them more time to complete the assignments. It may be a matter, I mean, I think a lot of it would have to do with reaching out to those students directly as best we can and their families and finding out what their situation is. I mean, now I think is the time to kind of work out some kind of individualized plan and with some kind of general guidelines, rather than issuing some blanket declaration that if you don't meet requirements by this date, you're automatically going to summer school. I mean, that, you know, we don't know what the situation, you know, we have to find out what the situations are first and make a decision appropriately based on that.
Have the teachers at your school been discussing this at all, or is basically everybody's waiting for a decision from DOE one way or another?
Well, in my school, there's been quite a bit of discussion and been There's been quite a variety of opinions about this. They range from let's try and adhere to as a policy that says, you know, close to our normal one as possible, to oh, let's just you know, pass everyone. What does it matter? And so there's just a wide range of opinions. And I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think we can use a normal grading policy. I also don't think it's helpful to say just pass everyone, because yeah. I have students who are doing an enormous amount of work. They're doing this beautiful work. Their class worksheets are just filled with detailed, thoughtful stuff. They're showing up to online meetings. They're participating. They're helping other students. And then I have students who are just barely doing the minimum. And there should be some way to differentiate between that, but not necessarily right. between an 84 versus an 85.
So we have several callers on the line. Katie, if you want to add something briefly, but let's get to one of the callers first. WBAI, you're on the air. Can you say your name, where you're from, and what your question is for Bobson and Katie?
Okay, I'm from Queens here, and I'm noticing that the Board of Ed system has changed since I went to school, because I went to a public school here in this city, and I can't believe how Department of Education has really privatized to the point that we don't know if we're going to have a public school anymore or it's going to become a charter school in a sense. And the fact is that these students are not getting the proper training. Years ago, you got an education, you knew that the school was there to support. But now, since you got this battle between the charter schools and the public school, that the teachers are not being paid a proper salary. And on top of it, the fact that the charter schools get all the information they need to run a school. And I think the fact that the mayor has done a lousy job of dealing with this. And since you have a new chancellor, which I don't know if he knows about the history of the school system, I doubt if this school system will be around anymore.
Well, it is true that there's been a rapid expansion of charter schools, many of them sharing buildings with public schools, and that has exacerbated inequities. The mayor said he was going to stop that expansion, but it continues. I don't know whether Bobson and Katie want to say anything about that. I don't know exactly how that relates to remote learning. Perhaps we should get another caller on the line. Can you say your name and where you're from and what your question and concern is for Bobson and Katie?
Are you there?
Yeah, hello? We're here. Yes, what's okay. your name?
My name is Ali Shaw Seaborg, AlyShawSeeburg.
Yeah, what's your question?
We
don't have much time.
Okay, all right. My question is, what about these junior high and high school kids? What are they going to do for the summer jobs? Who's going to provide income for them?
So that's a huge issue right now, because the mayor has canceled the funding for the summer youth program. I think it's more than $180 million they've canceled, and it's a huge concern. There is an active campaign going to reinstitute that budget, and we are hoping that that will happen. We have another caller on the line. Can you specifically say what your question is for Bobson and Katie as to the issues that we were talking about during the show?
Yeah, my name is David. I'm a retired New York City school teacher, 5 years out, and I think they're doing these young teachers are doing a marvelous job with the technology and all that. I just wanted to ask them what they think about the schools at 30. Lower class size would be wonderful, because I taught, when I was teaching, I had 38, 40 in the classrooms without equalization grievances, you know. But what's going to happen to the physical plan of the school? Will you have enough room? That's my question, to accommodate these students. And also, if I may just make a comment, hopefully this will end the ATR crisis, which is why I retired, where they take your programs away because of, you know, they don't know about that. But the first question, I'll get off the air. Thank you.
Thanks. Katie, you want to talk about class size and overcrowding?
Yeah, that is a really good question. We do need to lower class sizes when we go back. But, you know, I would envision, like, a lot more small group work, but And that's one reason why I push into classrooms, is because I don't have my own space to work with kids. And I'm there's one like empty classroom that like five of us share. And even for testing, it's like it's so hard to schedule testing. So yeah, that's a huge issue, is lack of physical space to do small group work.
And yeah, it's true. I think there are over 500,000 kids in New York City public schools that are in overcrowded schools and overcrowded classrooms. And Bobson, I know your school is very overcrowded now as well. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of the show. This is always the hardest part for me because I always want to talk more. But we have to get off. Thank you so much, Bobson and Katie, for spending time with us today, given your incredibly overstretched schedules. We really, really appreciate it. And maybe we can check in with you later in the year.
Sounds good. Yes,
thank you.
That would be great. Okay, this is Lanny Hampson, host of Talk Out of School. I hope you'll join us next Wednesday for another Talk Out of School. Until then, be careful and be safe. Thanks so much for listening.
Working your fingers right down to the bone. The guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell. The cook in the lunchroom ready to sell. If you can find a seat, you're fortunate if you have time to eat. Back in the classroom, open your books. Keep it, the teacher don't know how mean she looks. Soon as 3 o'clock rolls around, you finally lay your burden.